Chapter 18. Down on the strand, where the sea meets the land, where fishermen kneel over wounds that won't heal, and the water weeps at the end of the day, in the mirror you walk away. Among the red trees and the long dead leaves, the axeman wanders but cannot remember, and the earth runs like tears and will not stay. In the mirror you walk away. In the silent season, high on the hill's bastion, in the burning rain and the soul's dark stain, where the children lie where they lay, in the mirror you walk away. Along the furrows of his heels, a long shadow steals, down from the altar, pulled all the destinies fulfilled, tell the tale another god has had his day, and in the mirror you walk away. When on the grey fields the troubles fall still, another soldier's cause dies for what never was, drifting past the dreams now gone astray, in the mirror you walk away. Soiled the sacrament and broken the monument, sullied the sculpture and soured the rapture. Beauty lives, but brief its stay, and in the mirror you walk away. Gods will give and then take away. If faith tastes of blood, drink deep when you pray. Beauty lives, but brief its stay, and when it all goes away, and there's nothing left to save, in the mirror you walk away. In the mirror you walk away. Song of the Last Prayer in the Age of Adjudication. Sevul of Colance. He felt the nudge, and imagined himself in the hold of a ship, rolling in heavy swells. When the nudge came a second time, he thought of drunken knights, sprawled beneath a table with someone's booted foot thudding against him. With the third nudge, harder this time, delivered with irritation or impatience, he muttered a curse. But something had gummed together his lips, so the word came out as a moan. He decided it was time to open his eyes. That too proved a struggle, lids pulling apart as if glued, stinging viciously once he blinked his way clear. Gloom, blurred shapes, something like a face hovering over him. The air smelled of decay, the taste in his mouth was of old, old blood. And something else, bitter. It was, he decided, a taste of failure.
Get up!
Another figure, now kneeling beside him. A soft hand pressing against the side of his face, but his beard was stiff and it crackled under the palm, and the hand slipped away, only to come back, hard enough to rock his head. And a woman said,
"We don't have time for this. The door's open. Some people round here got a feel for things like that."
The first speaker said,
"Poison's gone inert, long ago. But he ain't moved in a while.
The guardian should have..."
"Off wandering the warrens, is my guess. Lucky us.
Just help him to his feet, will you?"
Hands under his arms, a grunt, and he felt himself leave the stone floor, except for his heels. Sudden pain in his lower back and his legs, as they tried to take his weight. He couldn't remember being this heavy. Was he ever this heavy?
"Stand up, damn you. I can't hold you up long."
"How do you think I felt?" the woman asked beside him. "He made all my bones creak."
He swore at the sharp stabs lancing out from his legs, tottered.
"There, back a step. Lean against the wall. Good, like that. Now look at me, idiot. Look at me like you know me."
It was dark, but he could make out the man's face now. Studied the eyes fixing on his own, and frowned.
"What's my name?" the man demanded.
He worked until he had some spit in his mouth, pushed with his tongue to force open his lips.
"I know you," he managed to say. "Your name, Blob."
"Blob?" The man's head turned towards the woman.
"He says my name is Blob.
Should I slap him again?"
"Blur," he now said, blinking at the woman. "Blob and blur. I remember now. You got me drunk. Took advantage of me. I should probably kill you both. Where are my trousers?
Still leaning against the wall, still using it to prop himself up, he glared at the man and the woman, watched them both back off a step. They were all in a corridor, and to his right was a thick wooden door, pushed open, revealing a snarled, lumpy mess of a yard just beyond, and a cool draught was slinking in, smelling of brackish water and rubbish. The man spoke slowly, as if to a child.
"You're wearing your trousers."
"Of course I am. Think I can't dress myself? Where are my knives?"
The woman swore under her breath and then said,
"The fool's lost his mind. Not hard, since it wasn't great to begin with, but it's gone now. He's useless to us. Cotillion lied, just wanted me out from underfoot, so he sent me riding wild as a she-witch, all for nothing."
"I'd agree with you on that assessment," said the other man, now crossing his arms, "except for one thing."
"What?"
"Blob and Blur. The bastard's having us on, Minala. And he thinks it's funny, too. See that glare? Like every ocean storm's come home to roost on his forehead. Thing is, Callum never glares. Almost never scowls. Callum's got the face of an assassin."
Callum sneered. "I'm having you on, am I? Tell you what, wizard, am I having you on the way you had me on when I cracked that acorn and you never showed? With about 100 claws closing in on me? Not my fault. Besides, look at you. You came out the other end still walking."
"Crawling, actually," corrected Minala. "According to Shadowthrone, I mean. In fact, the wispy runt had to drag Callum up to the door here. It's a wonder he even managed it."
Quick Ben snorted.
"So you ain't nearly as good as you think you are. What a shock. Look at your clothes and armor. You're chopped to pieces, oh mighty assassin. A handful of Lassine's weasels made a mess of you, and you've got the nerve to blame me."
"So where is she?" Callum demanded.
"Who?" "Lassine. I got to settle with her. She cut Tavare loose. She said the Wiccans have to be sacrificed, and Corbel O'Dom. I want that bastard's knobby head bouncing down every step from Moxhold to the mouth of the sewer. Where the fuck are my knives?"
Minala drew out a belted brace and flung the gear at his feet.
"So I come riding through 1,000 warrens, nearly get blasted by lightning, and you ain't got a single word for your hood-damned wife?
You threw me out, remember?"
"Remember? I'm remembering why, is what I'm remembering. This is all Cotillion's fault."
Quick Ben said,
"She won't say it, but she misses you."
She rounded on him.
"You stay out of this."
"I'd love to, but we haven't got time. Look, Callum, she's sincere. She even found you a horse. What do I need a horse for? We're in Mala's city. If Lassine's run away, I don't need a horse. I need a ship." "Callum, listen to me. Shadow Throne delivered you to the dead house. You were dying, poisoned. And then you were just, left here, lying there on the floor for some time. Well, a fair bit of time, in fact. Did you kill Lassine, then? Did you avenge me? And you have the nerve to call yourself my friend? You didn't kill her, did you? Did you?" "No, I didn't. Just close that trap of yours and try listening for a change. Never mind the Malazan Empire. Never mind the regent or protector or whatever title Malik Rel's come up with. And maybe Lassine got killed like they say she did. Or maybe she didn't. It doesn't matter. We're not hanging around, Callum. We're needed elsewhere. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
"Not a word. But it sounds to me like we're wasting time."
He looked at Minala.
"So you got me a horse, did you? Is it big enough? Better not be a stallion. You know how they get jealous when I'm around you."
"I wasn't picky," she said. "But if I'd thought about it, I'd have gotten you a fat, one-eared, three-legged ass. And you could take turns riding each other.
Not that anybody'd tell the difference. God's below you two,
hissed Quick Ben, with a sharp look out into the yard.
Trying to wake up the whole waterfront? We've got to go, now.
Callum collected the weapon belt, checked to confirm that the sheaths held his long knives. But his memory still wasn't the way it should have been, so he couldn't be sure. But they looked to be decent weapons, anyway.
Fine. Shut up, the both of you, and let's get going.
Outside, beneath a strangely green, cloudy night sky, Quick Ben led the way down the winding path between overgrown mounds and dead trees. They reached the gate, and the wizard gestured off to their left. The horses were tethered to a hitching post in front of a sunken tavern 30 paces away. Rising waters had flooded the taproom, leaving the place abandoned and dark. As they set off for them, Callum narrowed his gaze on one of the beasts. His steps slowed.
Hold on, he whispered. That ain't a horse. Best I could do, Quick Ben muttered. Don't worry, it's mine.
4 paces from the rail, and a hulking, armored figure stepped out from the tavern's nearest alley. 2 heavy blades clashed together and then lifted threateningly. Quick Ben swore.
Look, Temper, I knocked. Nobody home.
The visored face swung to study the dead house, and then a deep voice rumbled out.
I might have to kill you 3 anyway.
Why?
Yelped Quick Ben. Temper pointed with one of his huge swords.
You didn't close the fucking door.
I'll be right back.
They watched the wizard hurry back to the dead house. Temper turned to Callum.
He never fooled me, you know. I don't know what Whiskey Jack was thinking.
You smell of Coop's ale, said Callum. I'm thirsty. Listen, Minala, when Quick gets back, tell him...
Don't even try, she said in a growl. Besides, here he comes.
Done, said Quick Ben when he returned. His teeth flashed white as he smiled.
Temper slid his weapons back into their sheaths.
I suppose I don't really need to say this to any of you, but don't come back. We like it sleepy here. I see any of you again.
Quick Ben's smile vanished and he sighed and shook his head.
Temper, you should have bolted to the bridge burners when you had the chance. I hear they're all dead.
The wizard swung atop his ethereal horse and grinned down.
Exactly.
Examining the natty gelding Minala had found for him, Callum glanced over.
Do you like being retired, Temper?
No, it's an honest question. Do you like it?
Night like this, seeing you all eager to ride out. Into serious trouble, no doubt. Aye, assassin, I like it. And if you want to do the same, I'll stand you a tankard of Coops in yonder inn before throwing you into the harbour.
I'll get back to you on that, Callum replied, mounting up.
He looked across to Minala and then Quick Ben.
All right, unless these horses can run on water, someone needs to crack open a warren.
Well, said Quick Ben, mine can.
Smug as ever, I see.
In any case, warrens are my business.
And how's business? Callum asked.
Awful. But that's all about to change.
Really? How?
God's below, Callum. Because I'm back, that's why. Now stop talking and leave me to it, will you?
When the 3 riders were gone, and the tattered wisps of foul-smelling smoke had drifted away, Temper swung round, stepped back into the gloom of the alley, and studied the wraith-like figure standing amidst the rubbish.
Old loyalties, he said. The only reason I let them go. The dead house isn't a damned toll booth, Emperor.
A cane cracked its silver heel hard on the grimy stones.
Emperor? I left that behind long ago. And as for the days when I gave kindly advice, well, they never existed. But for this once, and for you alone, Temper,
A word of caution. Watch how you talk to gods, mortal, lest they...
He suddenly giggled.
Take umbrage.
Temper grunted, said nothing for a dozen heartbeats, and then...
Umbrage.
Huh. He turned to leave, and Shadow Throne struck the cobbles again. The huge warrior paused, looked over. Shadow Throne hissed.
Well, is that it?
Is what it?
That's all you have to say? This is a momentous scene, you fat fool. This is where everything really, truly, finally begins. So squeeze the ale from your brain, mortal, and say something worthy of your kind. You stand before a god. Speak your eloquence for all posterity. Be profound.
Profound? Huh?
Temper was silent for a long moment, studying the cobbles of the alley mouth. And then he lifted his helmed head, faced Shadow Throne, and said,
Fuck off!
Sister Belai watched the man pick his way carefully through the mass of rubble that had once been the citadel gate. He wasn't especially tall. He had nothing of the brawn common to a veteran soldier, though a white scar was visible climbing one side of his jaw up to a clipped ear. That didn't look like a sword cut, she decided.
Something bit him. Would Sister Reverence appreciate that? A jaghut's tusk, perchance? Not likely.
No, there wasn't much to this man. Nothing to explain the source of his defiance, his infuriating resistance to the will and voice of the Watered. This was about to change, of course. The enemy commander had just made a fatal error in agreeing to this parley. For Sister Belai's blood was not watered, and this man was about to discover the power in the voice of a pure-born Forkrell Asael. The smoke-stained, cracked walls of the citadel were proof of the effort the watered commanders had made in seeking to conclude this siege, and the thousand or so rotting corpses lying on the killing ground beneath those walls marked the savage determination of the Shriven. But every assault thus far had ended in defeat.
Yes, the enemy has done well. But our patience is at an end. It is time to finish this.
The fool was unguarded. He came out alone. Not that it would have mattered, for she would have used his own bodyguards to cut him down. Instead, she would make him take his own life, here, before the horrified eyes of his soldiers lining those battlements. The enemy commander picked his way past the corpses and then drew to within 10 paces of where she stood. Halting, he eyed her curiously for a moment and then spoke in passable Khalansi.
A pure, then. Is that the correct term? Not mixed blood. The ones you call watered, as in watered down, presumably. No, you are a true Forkrell Asael. Have you come to adjudicate? And he smiled.
Human arrogance ever takes my breath away, Sister Belai observed. Perhaps under certain circumstances it is justified. For example, when dealing with your own kind, whom you have made helpless and at your mercy, or in the matter of dealing with lesser beasts, when they presume to defy your tyranny. In the palace of the now dead King of Kolantz, there is a vast chamber crowded with stuffed trophies, animals slain by those of the royal line, wolves, bears, cats, eagles, stags, elk, Bedarin. They are given postures of ferocity to mark that final moment of defiance, their presumption to the right to their own lives, one supposes. You are human as was the King of Kolantz. Can you explain to me this sordid need to slay animals? Are we to believe that each and every beast in that chamber sought to kill its slayer?
Well, now, the man replied, I admit to having a personal opinion on such matters, but you have to understand, I never could comprehend the pleasure of slaughter. Those whom I have met who have enjoyed such activities, well, the reasons they tend to give don't make much sense to me. You could have simply asked the King of Colance.
I did,
Sister Balai said, nodding. His brows lifted. And?
He said it made him feel one with the animal he killed.
Ah, I've heard similar.
Accordingly, she resumed, I killed all his children and had them stuffed and displayed in the same chamber. It was my wish that he feel one with his offspring, too.
I imagine that wasn't very successful. She shrugged.
Let us hear your opinion, then.
Some needs are so pathetic they cannot be satisfied except by killing. I don't mean those among us who hunt out of necessity. That's just food. But let's face it, as soon as you start planting fields and keeping livestock, you don't need to hunt for food anymore.
The king also said it was his means of worshipping nature.
By destroying it?
Just my thought, human. But then, is that not your principal means of worship?
Now that is a perceptive, if slightly painful, observation. But consider this. In killing and stuffing those children, were you not expressing the same detestable arrogance that so offended you in the first place?
It was an experiment to see if I too could feel one with those I had slain. Alas, I did not. I felt sad that I should have such power in my hands and should choose to use it for destructive ends. And yet I discovered something else, a truth about myself, in fact. There is pleasure in destroying, and it is a most sordid kind of pleasure. I suspect this is what is confused with the notion of oneness by such chronic slayers.
You're probably right.
Because they are, in fact, not particularly intelligent.
I assumed you would arrive at that opinion sooner or later.
Why?
Well, it sounds as if you feel a need to justify killing us. And while you have pity for the lesser beasts of this world, your definition of lesser beasts does not include humans. Yet ironically, your justification is predicated on the very same notion of arrogant superiority that you found so reprehensible in the Colance royal family. The beast that knows no better can be slain with impunity. Of course, there is no logic to that notion at all, is there?
Sister Balai sighed. That was most enjoyable. Now I need you to take your own life, so that we may end this pointless battle. I would like to be able to tell you that your army will be well treated, and so on. But the truth is, I will command them, just as I command the Shriven. And with the power of my voice, I will set them against my enemies, whoever they may be, and they will fight without fear. They will fight with a ferocity the like of which has never been seen among your kind, because I intend to use them the way you use horses or war dogs. In other words, like well-trained beasts.
What a depressing notion, Forkrul Asael. Those pathetic needs I talked about, they all come down to power. The king killed those animals because he had the power to do so, and expressing that power made him feel good. But it never lasts long, so out he goes to kill some more. I find it pathetic. And all that you have just said to me here, well, it's really the same old shit. By your voice and the sorcery of Akrast Corvalain, you will seek to fill that void in your soul. The void that is the hunger for control, when the bitter truth is you really control nothing, and the universe is destined to swallow you up just as it does everything else.
You do not believe in the power to do good? To do what is right?
The hold of the beasts wants vengeance. It wants to redress the balance of slaughter. Messy as that would be, at least I see the logic of it. But I fear it's too late. Their age is past, for now.
We will prove the lie of your words, human.
No, you won't. Because, Forkrul Asael, you are going to fail. And in failing, you fail your allies as well. and for them the misery simply goes on and on. The only end to the tragedy of the beasts will come at the hands of humans, and to the wolves I would advise patience. They need do nothing more, because we humans will destroy ourselves. It may take a while, because there's lots of us, but we'll do it in the end, because we are nothing if not thorough. As for you and your kind, you're not even relevant.
Draw your knife, human. Kneel.
I'm sorry, but I can barely hear you. She blinked.
Draw your knife.
Barely a whisper, I'm afraid. He drew out a small wooden card. I am Ganos Paran. I was a soldier in the Malazan army, a marine, to be precise. But then I became the master of the deck of dragons. I didn't ask for the title, and had no real understanding of the role for quite some time. But I'm getting the hang of it now. He held up the card. This is where your voice is going. It's another realm where the only things hearing you, or rather succumbing to your power, are insects and worms in the mud. They're confused. They don't know what a knife is. They don't even know how to kneel. Sister Belai stepped forward.
Then I shall break you with my hands.
He seemed to lean back, and suddenly he was gone. The card fell, clattered on the stones. She reached down, picked it up. The image was little more than a scratching of lines, a rough landscape, a hint of ground, low plants. And there, vague in the gloom, stood the man. He beckoned, and in her mind she heard his voice. Come after me, Forkrul Asael. I invite you to do battle with me here. No? Well, it was foolish of me to think you were that stupid. After all, I need only step out of this wretched place, leaving you trapped, and it'd be a long, long time before you found your way home. Well, we have now met. We are enemies known to one another, as it should be. You cannot enslave my army. If you want to defeat us, you'll have to do it the hard way. Oh, by the way, I enjoyed our little talk. I think I now understand you better than you do me, which is an advantage I intend to exploit. Oh, if you could see your expression now. With a snarl, she snapped the card in half, flung the pieces to the ground. Whirling, she marched back to where her officers waited.
Summon Brother Grave. Assemble the legions. We shall end this.
One of the warted stepped forward tremulously and bowed.
Pure, we need reinforcements. And you shall have them. We shall sustain this assault. Give them no rest. Brother Grave waits with 3 legions. I will have that human's hide nailed to the wall of this citadel.
The warted grinned.
A worthy trophy, Pure.
She faced the edifice once more.
I will, she whispered, because I can.
You fool, snapped Noto Boyle. She almost had you, didn't she?
Paran wiped at the mud caked on his boots. Find Fist Bued. Get the reserves ready. This one's going to be messy. And tell Mathok to mount up for a sortie before the bastards get a chance to set up.
Did she seek to command you?
I told you. I had an answer to that. But you're right. Those Forkrul Asael moved damned fast. It was close. Closer than I would have liked. But then, he smiled at the healer. We've stirred them up. Got 2 pure bloods over there now. And more legions to boot.
Let me guess, all according to your plan.
Where's Ormulogan? I need him to work on that etching, in case we need to get the hood out of here. Noto Boyle sighed, and set off to look for the Imperial artist. He chewed on his fish spine until he tasted blood.
You always could pick them, couldn't you, woman?
She'd been walking in her sleep again. This time out and down the steps into the cellar, where waited a dead friend. He was sitting on one of the kegs Antsy called the Sours,
one of those that held bodies of damned Segula. Not that they were there any more, but that pickling concoction was still one of the foulest brews she'd ever smelled. Was it Blue Pearl who'd given it a taste? She couldn't remember, but probably. He was sitting working a knife tip under filthy fingernails.
"Am I sleeping again?"
Picker asked.
"Yeah,"
Blue Pearl replied.
"But I'm telling you, Pick, getting dragged into your dreams like this ain't much fun."
"You know what's happened to this city?"
He grimaced, frowned at his nails.
"I voted against settling here. Do you remember that? But the Count didn't go my way. Story of my life. And then Darudistan went and killed me."
"But you didn't know why, did you? I can tell you why now, Blue Pearl. I know why now."
He sheathed his knife, and the sound the weapon made as it locked in the scabbard was sharp enough to make her breath catch. Looked across at her and said,
"We re-sanctified this place, did you know that? Spilling all that blood? It was stirring when we moved in, but then we went and drenched the stones in that red stuff."
"Meaning?"
He shrugged, drew out his knife again, and began cleaning his nails, each gesture the same as the time before.
"In here, Pick. We're safe."
She snorted.
"Maybe for you."
"You've got to go soon, Sergeant. Out of the city. Will there be trouble, you doing that?"
"You called me Sergeant."
"Aye, I did. Because I'm passing on orders here, that's all."
"Whose orders?"
He examined his nails.
"There's no such thing, Picker, as retiring from the bridge burners."
"Go back to Hood."
He grunted in amusement, clicked his knife home, the sound louder and more disturbing than the first time.
"Where Hood's at, I ain't going, Pick. We got us the right commander again, the one we should have had right from the start. By whose order, Sergeant?"
He drew out his knife and set to his nails again.
"Whiskey Jack."
"What's he got to do with any of this? I know who I'm supposed to find. I even know where he's holed up. And staying out of Darujistan tells me he's smarter than he looks."
Lifting an arm, she caught a flash of silver, stared in horror at the torques now encircling her upper arms.
"Gods below! How did these come back? Get 'em off me!"
"Treach needs you now. Tiger of summer and all that."
He grinned at her.
"It's all brewing up, my love."
"Shit! I just put 'em on because they look nice."
He was studying her, head cocked.
"Getting fat on us, Sergeant?"
She scowled.
"Taken to wearing chain under everything."
"Even when you're asleep? And you say you ain't a bridge burner no more?"
"What kind of dream is this?"
He sheathed his dagger. This time the click was sharp enough to make her flinch.
"The important kind, Sergeant. Look at it this way. Hood's gone. Death's gate was just gaping. But someone sanctified us. We've seen more death than a sane person could stand. But we ain't sane, are we? We're soldiers, veterans. We're past sane. We're in that other place where all the insanity's been storming around us for so long it can't touch us no more either. Meaning we're outside both. What makes us perfect for Death's Gate? Simple, Picker. It don't matter what we look at. We don't blink."
"I can get out of the city," she said, "but it won't be easy."
He began cleaning his fingernails, the knife blade flashing dull in the misty gloom.
"Glad to hear all that confidence has come roaring back. Thing is, we ain't in the mood to challenge what's going on here. Besides, we're kind of busy at the moment."
"So I'm on my own, is that it?"
"Not quite. We arranged for a reliable guide."
He rose. The dagger slammed back into its scabbard. The sound startled her awake, lying tangled in sweaty blankets, Blend snoring at her side. Something was at the door, trying to get in. Cursing under her breath, Picker collected up the sword propped beside the bed. She saw the latch flick once, the same sound Blue Pearl's dagger had been making. Whoever was trying to open that door wasn't having much luck.
"What a fine guide you sent there, Whiskey Jack. Can't even open a stupid door." "Hmm? Go back to sleep, love."
She rose and walked to the door, turned the latch with her sword point and stepped back to let the door swing open. A mangy cat sat in the corridor. Mangy?
"The ugly thing's dead. A hood damned undead cat! Gods below!
The creature had a collar made of thick hide or leather, twisted into a coil. A tarnished silver coin or medallion hung from it. Picker crouched, reached out and dragged the cat closer, frowning when it made no effort to walk, just sliding in its sitting position.
Gods, you stink!
Rotted eye sockets offered her about as much expression as any living cat might manage. She bent closer, took hold of the medallion. Feeble scratching marred both sides, a name in archaic Gadrobi or Rivi. She frowned at it.
Tufty?
So Blend and Ansi weren't just making stuff up. They were telling the truth. They'd found that Jaghut a damned dead cat. Then her eyes narrowed on the collar, skin mottled here and there by red ochre tattoos.
Oh, she muttered. Let me guess. Tilani Mas?
From the room behind her, Blend called out,
Pick? It's fine, Picker said, straightening. Just the cat. Did you feed it? I didn't feed it. Oh, gods, I can't remember when I last fed the cat.
Picker walked into the room. Sure enough, Blend was still sleeping, having one of those dreams. She went over and settled down on the mattress, leaned closer and whispered,
It's true, Blend. You forgot. For months.
The woman moaned, distress twisting her features, but her eyes remained shut.
You've made a real mess, Blend. That poor cat. I just found it, and Hood knows it ain't a pretty sight.
You could have fed it, Picker. Why didn't you feed it?
Something sharp pricked under Picker's chin, and she froze.
Better answer me,
Blend said in a casual tone.
You see, I loved that cat. Got it for my 6th birthday. It was my favourite cat.
Blue Pearl, Picker called out. Can you fix this, please? Blue Pearl?
No answer. Picker knew that if she tried to pull away, Blend's deadly instincts would answer with a fatal thrust up through her brain. She thought furiously.
I was only joking, love. Tufty's fine.
Blend's brow wrinkled.
Tufty? Who's Tufty?
The cat I forgot to feed.
The knife vanished beneath the blankets, and Blend rolled over.
You never was good with animals,
she mumbled, and then added,
Bet it hates you now. No more cuddles for you, Pick.
A moment later, she was snoring. Picker's sigh was ragged. Wiping sweat from her eyes, she glared across at the ugly thing in the doorway.
Lords above, I hope so.
And then she discovered the silver torques. The waters calmed, as they were wont to do whenever he came up from below deck. Shirkalal watched the Jaghut approach. The rest of her crew, the few that still lived, sat or sprawled amidships, tracking the tall, ghastly warrior with a fascination she almost envied. Here was the once god of death, and the exquisite irony of her meeting Hood was simply delicious. Back in Letharus, she'd have wagered her entire fortune that this was one encounter she would never have. Instead, she was captaining Hood's Ship of the Dead, or whatever it was he called it, Vessel of Souls, Death Ship. Something ominous, anyway. Not that she had much to do by way of giving orders and the like. Whatever propelled the craft wasn't slave to winds, canvas and cordage, and not an oar in sight. Suddenly the seas had become uninteresting, as if all her skills, and possibly it was the same with her crew, all their skills had become irrelevant. And for all the ease and comfort that came with this kind of sailing, her sense was one of tragic loss. At this moment her respect for the sea wavered, as if fatally weakened, and she wondered if, before long, there would come to humans a true conquest of the waves, spelling the end of humility.
And let's face it, humanity without humility is a dangerous force. Don't know why I'm thinking as if I'm seeing the future, but that's how it feels. Some future time when sorcery does too much, when it solves all our problems, only to invent new ones. If this is to be the real future, I don't want it. There is a darkness upon your thoughts, Captain Elal.
She glanced over at him, burnished tusks, mottled with unimaginable age, worn leathery skin stretched gaunt over sharp bones, deep-set eyes, haunted in shadow, the vertical pupils barely visible. But they'd not been there when he'd first appeared, so it seemed that life was returning to the Jaghut.
You can sense such things, Hood?
You are the captain.
I don't see the relevance of that. The title has lost all meaning.
To the contrary,
Hood replied.
It is by the currents of your thoughts that we find our course.
He pointed ahead. She squinted, a smudge building on the horizon.
I've conjured up a storm.
Out of witless boredom, I created ships like this one, and I set captains upon them, choosing those among the dead for whom death has become an obsession.
I imagine you'd have plenty to choose from. How can the dead not obsess over their being dead?
I am not responsible for small minds, Captain Elal. Indeed, I always possessed a kind of admiration for those who refused their fate, who struggled to escape my dreadful realm. Enough to let them go? Go? I can tell you that all those who have escaped my realm now exist in misery. For their path ahead is no longer a mystery, and for them hope does not exist. They know that no paradise awaits them, and that no amount of diligent worship, sacrifice, or piety can change that.
That is awful.
What it is, Captain, is inexcusable.
She considered his words, and then considered them some more.
The gods take, but give nothing in return.
Ah, see how the storm dissipates? Excellent, Captain. Oh dear, it now returns, much more virulent than before. Captain, I would advise...
Advise me nothing! Couldn't you have forced their hand, done something?
The strange, terrible eyes fixed on her.
But I have.
Then was it necessary for you to leave the realm of death? Is that why you're here? It must be. You have set something in motion.
I have not acted alone, Captain.
I would hear more, Hood. If there is a reason for all this, I need to know it.
Hood said nothing for a time, studying the roiling clouds marring the way ahead. Then he spoke.
I so dislike moments of revelation, Captain. One is invited to infer all manner of deliberation leading us to this place, this time, when the truth of it is chance and mischance rule our every step.
He sighed.
Very well. I am not indifferent to your needs. This possibility only gained life when two usurpers reawakened the remnants of Khorald Imulan, the realm of shadow, and then set out to travel the warrens, and indeed the holds, seeking knowledge, seeking the truth of things. What they eventually discovered did not please them, and in the boldness of their youth, they decided that something must be done.
Two new gods, Shurkelal murmured. They came to you?
Not at first. Instead, they sought out loyal allies among the mortals they had once commanded. Well, perhaps mortals is not quite accurate in some instances. No matter. Let us call it a wondrous conflagration of circumstance and character, a kind of audacity which made anything possible. Before long, they found the need to gather additional allies. Shall I list them for you?
Why not?
The Son of Darkness, who understood the true burden of a surrendered future, the fatality of empty faith.
the warlord of the sleeping goddess, who would defy the eternal patience of the earth itself, and stone wielder, the one who stood facing Caladan Brood, ensuring the world's balance. These two are destined to walk disparate paths, but what they seek is much the same. The Queen of Dreams, whose pool had grown still as death itself, the Lord of Tragedy, and, well, a host of others, all drawn into the fold.
Those you have named, are they gods?
Hood shrugged. Ascendants. The complexity of this beggars belief, to be honest. The sheer scale of contingencies, well, for all his peculiarities, let no one accuse Shadow Throne of failings in the matter of intelligence. The same can be said for Cotillion, for the patron of assassins well comprehended that just as certain individuals deserve a knife through the heart, so do certain ideas.
Yet mortals are part of this plan too.
Indeed.
The adjunct Tavare Paran?
Hood was silent for a moment.
This Congress, Captain, is not above cruel use of mortals.
That is unfair.
But consider what may be won here, Shur-Kelal.
I am, Hood, but no, that is unfair.
The storm, Captain?
Why does that surprise you?
She retorted.
Try telling me something that doesn't break my heart, then. Try telling me something that doesn't make me furious at your arrogance, your contempt.
We do not hold the adjunct Tavare Paran in contempt.
Really?
She asked, the word dripping with derision.
Captain, she takes our arrogance and humbles us.
And what's her reward?
Shook demanded. Hood looked away and then shook his head.
For her, there is none.
Tell me, Shurk said in a rasp, tell me she did not agree to this.
To that, Captain, I shall say nothing.
He stepped past her then and raised his hands.
We cannot survive the violence your thoughts have conjured, Captain. Thus I have no recourse but to intervene. Fortunately,
he turned to eye her briefly,
Male concurs.
Push it away, then,
Shur-Kelal snapped.
But I will bring it back, I swear it, to so use an innocent woman.
You begin to try me, Captain Elal. If you intend to fight me for the rest of this voyage, I must find us another captain.
Please do, Hood. I barely knew the adjunct, but...
He twisted round.
Indeed, you barely know her. I will tell you this, then. I looked out through her sister's eyes, through a helm's visor, in the moment that she died, and I stared up at my slayer, the adjunct Tavare Paran, and the blood dripping from her sword was mine. You will speak to me of innocence? There is no such thing.
Shur-Kelal stared at Hood.
So, in using her now, is this punishment?
Consider it so, if it eases your conscience.
She murdered her sister?
Yes.
Is it guilt that drives her now, Hood? Does she seek redemption?
I imagine she does.
Will she find it?
Hood shrugged.
What is it you're not telling me? I can sense something. The sister, the helm's visor. Hood, that murder. Was it an accident?
The Jaghut did not reply. Shurk stepped closer.
Does Tavare even know she killed her own sister?
Irrelevant, Captain Elal. It is the ignorant who yearn most for redemption.
After a moment, she stepped back, went to the side rail, stared out over the rolling grey swells, what Scorgon called swollen waters.
If we had met in your realm, Hood, she said, I would not have refused my state.
I would not have sought to escape. Instead, I would have tried to kill you. Many have, Captain. Good for them.
Swollen Waters.
Good. If she never discovers the truth, if she's made to carry that ignorance for the rest of her days, do you even care?
Do you imagine that knowledge would be a gift?
I don't know.
The truth may hide at your feet. The truth may lie coiled in high grasses. But it still has claws. It still has fangs. Be careful, Captain, where you step.
Food reserves are dwindling,
Falash said, and then sighed and looked up at her handmaiden.
Straits are dire for dear mother.
She sat straighter, arched her back and groaned.
Do you advise rest? These journeys through troubled realms, by Jaghut's cold breath or not, do take their toll upon my delicate self. But I must refuse your concerns, my dear. Necessity demands... Is that wine you're pouring? Excellent. I thought that long gone.
I made a request, Highness.
Indeed? Of whom?
It seems, the woman said, passing over a cup, libations in the name of death continue unabated. And if the once god of that dread underworld is not above trespassing in his old, haunts, well, far be it from us to complain.
Just so. Nonetheless, sweetie, I dislike the notion of you consorting with that hoary creature. Best keep a respectful distance, matching my own wise caution in this matter.
As you wish.
But I must say, superb wine, given its provenance. I trust you have acquired a decent supply.
Luckily, yes, Highness.
The other news is almost as dire, I'm afraid. We have cause now to mistrust the motivations of the perished Greyhelms. Most disturbing.
The handmaid's eyes narrowed as she set to filling a bowl of rust leaf. Are we not at this moment sailing to a rendezvous with the perished fleet, Highness?
Assuming no calamity had struck, yes. But what is their disposition? The answer to that question is now paramount.
Perhaps I could scry.
No, we cannot risk that. The warren of the Forkerel Assail waxes full. Was I being poetic there, or succumbing to cliché?
I wouldn't know, murmured the handmaiden, concentrating on lighting the pipe.
We have been careless in your education. Never mind. Too late now. For it is well known that a person's brain ossifies at a certain age, becoming incapable of new acquisition, barring simple matters such as languages, martial skills, and so on. There is a moment when true genius is within the reach of any and every child, and the gauge of that moment's duration is in fact the only means of defining intelligence. Thus, while you are naturally bright, and therefore it is probable that the time of your receptivity could have been measured in months, if not years, we have done all we thought to do at that juncture, and the time for regrets is past. My dear, what was in this wine? My mouth seems to be running all by itself. For most people, of course, that moment of receptivity was sadly brief. A day, half a day. And alas, once gone, it can never return.
Excuse me, Highness, your pipe is lit.
Good, give it over. About this wine.
There was a knock upon the cabin door. And a moment later the latch lifted and First Mate Scorgon Caban, the pretty, loomed in the doorway, knuckling his brow.
Princess, highest of highs, beg your pardon. Got urgent happenings up top, if you please. Captain requests your presence.
Falash sighed.
Very well, assuming I am able to, stand. Some assistance.
The handmaid reached out to steady her.
Lead on, Scorgon,
Falash said with a careless wave of one hand.
And if you must ogle my tits, try being subtle about it, will you?
Sorry, Highness. Only got the one good eye, you know.
They paused and waited while the handmaid got over a sudden fit of coughing. Shurkalal turned as her first mate clumped up to her.
Captain, the squall witch! She's drunk!
Pretty, was that meant to be a whisper?
Greetings, Highness.
Drunkenness lies in the purview of the low-born. Captain, allow me to assure you that I am neither drunk nor low-born. But I must ask, where is our jaggered guest?
Shook grunted. Thought you'd have passed him on the way up. There is the matter of keeping at least one knife well hidden, you see.
No, Captain, I am afraid I do not.
Ah, of course. Shurk pointed ahead. We have been sighted by that ship, and it now bears down on us. Not a throne of war, Colancian, one presumes. Somewhat unsteadily, the princess made her way to the captain's side.
Oh, dear, she said. That is an SL ship. At the very least, a lesser watered will be commanding. Most distressing, of course, are the implications.
As in, ventured Shurkalal, where is the Perish fleet?
Precisely. And if that is not sufficiently alarming, I am afraid that I have been engaged in exhausting rituals this day. If we must fight, I will be of little use. We have already experienced the danger posed by Forkrell Asael, by both their physical prowess and the sorcery of their voice.
I need no reminders, Highness, and while I proved immune to such magics, the same cannot be said for my crew. And now you tell me that you are unable to defend us. So much for hiding one knife, Highness.
We shall see. We have, after all, my handmaid.
Shurk glanced over at the woman, recalling her attacks upon Sister Equity. She did not fare so well against a pure, Highness.
Well, a higher watered's assail blood is, watered down, and is not quite as powerful. In any case, it remains to be seen how this will play out. After all, this could be one of the betrayers among the Asael. In the meantime, Captain, may I suggest your first mate gather your crew and make for the hold?
Scorgon, take him down and keep him quiet.
Aye, Captain.
There was something skeletal about the Asael ship. Two types of wood were visible, one bone white and the other dull black. The hull was narrow of beam and high castled, and with the two masts offering minimal canvas, Shurk suspected that it had been built to ply sheltered waters. An open sea gale could well swamp such a ship. At twice the mass of her old raider, the Undying Gratitude, Shurk judged it to have a complement of 70 or so sailors on board, along with 20 or more marines, and as the craft came around and fell off before the wind on the port side of the death ship, she stepped to the rail and looked across. A tall, spectral figure was staring down on her, flanked by two helmed guards cloaked in chain surcoats. A few paces behind the captain, Princess Falash said,
"Dearie, those marines."
"Yes, Highness," the handmaid replied.
"Captain?"
"Highness?"
"Why not ask them what they want?"
Shurk turned to eye the princess. Before she could say anything, however, there were shouts from the Asael ship, and she swung back to see the handmaid scrambling up the side. Shit, wish I'd seen that leap. The craft was wallowing at least 6 paces away. Princess, what is that woman doing? The handmaid drew herself up and over the rail. The deck was an eye-hurting maze of black and white wood, like a shattered mosaic. 6 more helmed, chain-clad marines stood near the mainmast, now drawing heavy cutlasses. The Asael half-blood commander wore a heavy jeweled cloak. The thick oiled wool dyed a deep blue. Torques of gold collared her long neck, and her head was shaved, emphasizing the angled planes of her skull. She was unarmed, and she now faced the handmaid with a look of amused surprise, lifting a hand to stay her soldiers. Looking round, the handmaid saw recent storm damage. Much of the rigging had been torn away, and mounds of cordage and shattered stays littered the deck. There seemed to be less than a score of hands working on repairs.
"Inform your captain," said the Asael half-blood, "that having entered territorial waters, she must abide by the laws of High Colance. I am lesser-watered intransigent, inquisitor of the southern fleet."
"Not much of a fleet," the handmaid observed. The inquisitor blinked.
"A sudden storm has temporarily scattered us. To resume my message to your captain, she and her crew, including all passengers, must accept adjudication."
"By adjudication, do you mean killing?"
The pale-skinned woman smiled,
the expression seeming to fold the two sides of her face slightly inward.
The proclamation of restitution has been sanctioned. We continue the task. And did this fate befall the parish? Yours is not a parish ship, she frowned. I sense enmity from your vessel. And that fat little girl with the pipe, she is a mage, is she not? We shall adjudicate her first.
The handmaid walked back to the rail and leaned over.
Highness, she called down, there being a little cagey regarding the parish, might be you were right.
Anything else that might be important?
Falash asked.
No, Highness, only that they want to kill us.
Very well, carry on.
The handmaid turned round. The lesser watered spoke.
Reach not for your weapons. Kneel. For each and every one of you, the healing of the world begins with your death. Among all the reasons to die, is there one more worthy than this? Be thankful that we give meaning to your end. Kneel.
The handmaid shook her head.
A pure already tried all that. Caught me off guard for a moment or two. My will is not yours to command.
She moved then, rather faster than they'd expected, her hands thrusting outward, striking the bodyguards in the chest. Both warriors were lifted from their feet, over the rail, plummeting to the waters below. She ducked at that instant, evading the lesser's lashing attack, and kicked at the second joint on the woman's left leg, folding it halfway between the knee and the ankle. Her attacker stumbled, and the handmaid slipped past her, spinning round and out to one side to meet the six marines. Behind them, others were coming up from below, she saw. She drew her fighting knives. She needed bigger weapons. The marine closest to her wielded a nice pair of cutlasses. She would take those. Shurkalal loosed a startled oath and then leaned forward to watch the two armored guards plunge into the choppy waters between the ships. Both men vanished in a froth of bubbles. Turning to Falash, she asked, "Does she need help over there?" Plucked brows lifted.
"I certainly hope not."
The sounds of fighting, blades clashing, shouts and then screams, came from the deck of the other ship.
"Princess, this handmaid of yours, where did she come from?"
"Ah, now that is a mystery.
Enlighten me.
Do we have the time? Well, I suppose we do."
She puffed on her pipe, her face disappearing briefly behind a plume of smoke, and then said,
"My mother's account, this. There were seven of them. Six remain. The seventh, well, there was some kind of private challenge that, failed. No matter. Now, I will grant you they appear young, but do not let that deceive you. My mother concluded that alchemies constituted a worthwhile investment in maintaining the vigor of her six eldest daughters' handmaids. And we daughters are, of course, sworn to secrecy in all such matters, perpetuating the illusion that we have simply grown up with our loyal companions, and so on."
She paused then, when another chain-clad marine spun head-first over the rail, trailing blood over the side. A loud splash followed.
"They were most recalcitrant about divesting themselves of their horrid masks, but in the end my mother's will prevailed."
Shurkalal frowned. "Masks?" The sailors made a mess of things as the lesser watered, in her pain and panic, used the sorcery of her voice to command them. And it was some time before the handmaid worked her way through the howling mob. Frenzied rage had shock value, and the crew's utter lack of the instinct for self-preservation made things rather frantic for a few moments, but there was nothing tactical in their efforts to bring her down. When at last the handmaid stepped over a sprawl of bleeding bodies and approached the Inquisitor, she was breathing hard and sweat stung her eyes. The woman facing her cradled a broken arm, stood hunched over a dislocated shoulder and glared across at the handmaid.
"What manner of demon are you?"
she demanded in a ragged hiss.
"For an answer to that," the handmaid replied with a half-smile, "best look elsewhere."
The Inquisitor scythed out one leg. The handmaid leapt high, swung down, and severed the limb just above the knee. As she came down, her other cutlass cut into the vertical hinge of the woman's face, splitting it in two. A backswing with the pommel of the first cutlass slammed into the side of the Inquisitor's skull, punching through.
Pouring out blood, the corpse crumpled at her feet. The handmaid looked round. No movement among any of the other bodies.
Just as Mother taught.
She glanced down at the cutlasses in her hands, and then let them fall with a clatter.
Pieces of shit.
She went looking for her knives. Hood returned to the deck once they were underway. The once god of death looked back, frowned at the burning ship in their wake.
"Would have stopped her firing it,"
Shurkelal muttered, following the Jaghut's gaze, "if I'd had the chance."
"Oh, why is that, Captain?"
"Well, that column of smoke can be seen from a long way off."
"Indeed."
And Hood turned to her then and smiled.
"I must leave you now," Ublala grunted.
"I knew you weren't my friend."
"I assure you," Draconis said, "that I am, Ublala Pang. But events have occurred that now force my hand. As for you, a different destiny awaits."
"I hate destiny."
"Do you understand the meaning of the word?"
Ublala looked across at Ralata and scowled.
"Of course I do. It's the place where you end up. Everyone knows that."
"In a manner of speaking, perhaps. I fear you have mistaken it for destination. Ublala, destiny is the fate you find for yourself. Many hold to the belief that it is preordained, as if the future was already decided and there is nothing you can do to escape it. I do not. Each of us is free to decide."
"Then I'm going with you. My wife can go somewhere else. She keeps talking about babies, but I don't want babies. They get in the way of having fun, and people who end up having them spend all day talking about how great it is, but they look miserable even when they're smiling. Or worse, they're those ones who think their baby is the god of genius reborn, and even its poo smells like flowers. And all they do is talk about them forever and ever, and it's so boring I want to run away, or break their necks, or drown them all in the slop bucket."
"A rather uncharitable view, Ublala."
"I don't give nothing for free, that's for sure. Whole people disappear when a baby arrives. Poof! Where'd they go? Oh, I know, they're crawling around making baby noises. It makes me sick."
He ducked the rock Ralata threw at him and continued.
"So I'm going with you, and if you were a real friend, you'd take me, because if I make a baby, my life is over. Over!"
"Can you fly, Ublala?"
"That's not fair."
"Nevertheless, and no, I will not carry you. Now listen to me. We have gone as far west as needed. Now you must strike northward."
"Why?"
Draconis glanced away, eyes narrowing, and then he sighed and said,
"Your innocence is a gift, Ublala Pang. A rare gift. It must endure. It must be protected, but that I can no longer do. Walk northward, that is all I ask."
"Where am I going?"
"I cannot say for certain," Draconis admitted. "Nothing is certain, especially now."
"Will you come back?"
Draconis hesitated, and then he shook his head.
"I do not think we will meet again, no. And for that I truly grieve."
"Are you going somewhere to die?"
"Do not weep, friend. I do not know what awaits me."
He stepped close to Ublala.
"I have left you sufficient food and water for a week's travel. Beyond that, well..." He shrugged, and then held out a hand. "Now, let us clasp arms."
Instead, Ublala wrapped the god in a fierce hug. After a moment, Draconis pulled himself free.
"You give reason, friend, for what I must attempt. If sorcery must die, the magic in the mortal soul will persevere. Or so I choose to believe."
Ralata hissed.
"Kill him, Ublala. Kill him now. You can do it. Snap his neck. Take that sword."
Ublala winced and then shrugged.
She's always going on like this. She don't mean anything by it, Draconis. Honest.
He wiped at his eyes.
Goodbye. I'll never see you again.
And this time he burst into tears, wailing with his hands over his eyes. When Relata rushed to him, scrabbling to draw his knife, Ublala batted her away between sobs. She was thrown back, sailing through the air and then landing hard, limbs flailing before falling still. Frowning, Draconis walked over, crouched down. Unconscious. Well, that is something, I suppose. Sniffling, Ublala said,
Women always get jealous about man friends. Sometimes they say bad things about them. Sometimes they try to knife them. Sometimes they sex them. Sometimes they run away with them. Sometimes they get so mad they just up and die. But it's all just stupid.
Draconis straightened, walked a short distance away, and then turned to face Ublala one more time. Be well, Ublala Pang.
Don't die, Draconis!
The god smiled. I shall try not to. Ublala watched his friend disappear inside a bloom of black ethereal darkness, watched as the darkness found shape, spreading wings, a long serpent neck, a massive head with rows of scimitar-length fangs, eyes of lurid yellow. The dragon lifted into the sky, the vast wings hissing with the sound of cold water on hot stones as the creature wheeled and set off. With an uneven sigh, the Teblor collected the pack containing the food, and then the heavy water skins. Along with his weapons and armor, the burden was enough to make him grunt when he straightened. Grasping Relata by one ankle, he began walking. The way she was right now, why, a wife was as bad as a baby. Brother Diligence arrived well ahead of the retinue, his boots echoing as he strode the length of the throne room. All the bloodstains remained, splashed and smeared across the marble tiles, along the pillars to either side and the walls behind them, and upon the throne itself where sat Sister Reverence. Restitution had begun here, in this very chamber, and it was proper to remind all who would enter. Halting before Reverence, the only other person present, he said,
We must assume that they are lost to us, sister.
I smell smoke, brother.
Indeed.
Excellent.
She paused and then said,
Lost. Now that is a curious word. Are they dead, or are they now treasonous to our great cause?
If the former, sister, we must then reconsider the enemies arrayed against us.
And if the latter, then we must reevaluate the loyalty among us.
The issue lies with Sister Calm, said Brother Diligence. Equity but follows.
Not precisely true, brother. Equity is the heart of the ideals which they would hold, but it is Calm who adheres to the practical. Her long imprisonment, horrific as it must have been, has greatly damaged her spirit, I am afraid. We must indeed hope that she is dead, more so than poor misguided Equity.
I have received a missive from the siege, sister. The assault failed.
Reverence sat straighter.
But how can this be?
Sister Belai informs me that Akrast Corvalane is ineffectual against the commander of the besieged.
Impossible, unless he is a god, an ascendant?
Neither, I am told. This man, a mortal, titles himself the Master of the Deck of Dragons. He commands the Warrens in ways Sister Belai cannot quite understand. But what she describes at last explains the sudden appearance of that army. They arrived via a portal, traveling by Warren. Incidentally, this is why they could not get closer to us here at the Spire, where our sorcerous influence is strongest.
I see. Then this master's power cannot challenge us.
He and his army represent a military threat nonetheless. I now advise we dispatch another 3 legions, commanded by another Pure.
Ready the legions, brother, but do not send them to Estobance. Not yet. The challenge posed by the Master of the Deck of Dragons intrigues me. I will think some more on how to deal with him.
As you wish, sister.